Well, good afternoon, everyone. Good morning, wherever you are in the world. This is John Marchando, and welcome to another episode of Two Guys and a PLC podcast. I am joined by my partner in crime,
Dave Gutshall. How is everybody? Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Just a reminder for everybody out there, this is for entertainment purposes only, and it should not be assumed that any views expressed or have anything whatsoever to do with our day job and employers. And that goes for both John and myself, as well as our special guest today, Mr. Matthew Nalbone.
Mr. Nalbone, welcome.
So glad you're here.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. It's exciting times for sure.
Always exciting, especially when you're here. I'm so glad you could.
Right,
I think
thanks.
This is our fourth one, and you were on our early cut list to try and get on here. Fun fact, you're actually the first person on the list that I believe is officially ex-day job.
Yeah, non-Cisco, right?
Non-Cisco.
Yeah, we've had only Cisco people up to this point, so.
I thought you were going to say you're the first person in the list that actually accepted, but you know, that's a different story.
Well, you know, well said.
We haven't had any no's yet.
I was going to say, Matt, do you want to do a quick intro for those out there that don't know you?
Sure. So as you guys have already covered, formerly a Cisco person, focused mainly in industry things, oil and gas specifically. I have a new day job. I don't know if we're talking about new day job places. I don't know if that's worth mentioning, or is that considered a commercial? I don't know.
No, you can talk. Yeah, so say whatever you like.
Yep.
Great. So I'm just making sure. So made my way over to WWT on the partner side, still focused mainly on oil and gas and supporting our internal teams. So it's been an interesting transition, to say the least, being on yet another side of the table from customer to Cisco to here. But it's again, interesting. So having a good time.
And how long has it been now, Matt?
Just over 2 years.
Wow.
It's flown by, trust me.
Wow.
It doesn't seem like it's been that long at all.
No, literally, it feels like you were here just yesterday. Yeah.
Keep
stopping. Yeah, the quote
on
I said earlier was, the closer the end of the toilet paper roll you get, the faster it goes.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, we were actually referring to age at the time, not
not being on a toilet. Yes.
Yeah, not the right, exactly.
Right on.
I mean, just for clarity.
Yeah,
right?
Just for clarity. That's right.
Right on.
So talk to us, Matt, about, you know, we've kind of focused primarily on maybe the discrete side of manufacturing, not a lot on the process side. And obviously, you know, I think we all think of the oil and gas space as way more process related in most places. So, you know, give us kind of your sort of opinion, right? I mean, I think this is the place that, you know, was in the doldrums, or everybody was worried that it was going to be in the doldrums a couple of years ago because somehow, you know, electricity was going to be made out of thin air and that everything goes to EVs and suddenly hydrocarbons don't matter. Obviously, that's not the case. Now we're kind of in this. Yes. Yeah, so just give us your kind of opinion of kind of the O&G space coming into the next 12 months.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going away, right? I mean, we have all these goals for getting to certain places, you know, zero emissions by 2050, looking at how we can eliminate these dirty industries. But I mean, the fact is that there's so many things that go beyond just fuel sources, right? There's product-centric things coming out of this industry. Everything, you're talking about EVs, you know, I say this a lot, I'm sure a lot of people have said the same thing, but how much of that EV is made from petroleum products itself, right? So, I mean, getting out of it entirely is not the possibility. Yeah. Obviously, switching from as a fuel source, sure. I mean, we can get there, but it has to happen through what I like to say is natural terms or something a little more organic. It's not a flip of the switch. We all know that, right? Well, people who are reasonable know that. And I think people get caught up in some of that.
Yeah, from the plastics to lubrication that, you know, you have to use in an electric car just to start there. I mean,
no, exactly. And, you know, and people, I think, overlook that or just choose to ignore it, I think maybe is probably more accurate than they don't know. I think they do know, but they choose to ignore that as a portion of what they're against.
Yeah, we're,
but,
we're
I mean,
in
the industry
almost,
is itself.
Yeah,
go ahead, Dave.
Sorry about that. We're in almost the oversimplification of everything. So everything, it's almost like we can't get our arms around the complicated anymore or the nuanced. And so to your point, like everybody jumps from like one extreme to the other. there's not a realization that like the world does not work that way. Nothing works that
right.
way.
Right. Yeah. And when it's artificially forced or artificially pushed upon things, it doesn't tend to go well. So I think we have to let it take its natural course. Over time, we will eventually be to the Star Trek economy. All those people that are looking for that, we'll get there one day. I think I'll be long gone. But, I mean, it'll happen. Yeah. It's just, you know, 300-400 years away. You know what I was going to say? Yeah, what I was going to say is the industry itself. I mean, the hot topics, as always, your sustainability. But what does that mean? The sustainability, I think, is two things. It's the sustainability when they're talking about, you know, it's things as simple as reducing scope 1 and scope 2 emissions. But it's also the sustainability of the business itself, right? How can we change and adapt to make sure that we as an organization are continuing to operate, right? That's one, the two-pronged approach to sustainability. I think another big hot topic, and I'll just cover two just to get into anything here is, you know, security of supply. We hear over and over again, cyber attacks. We saw a few years ago with that major pipeline company in the Southeast, you know, the issues they had. We've had the invasion of Ukraine and what's happened with gas supply and what's going on in Europe. I mean, I think security of supply is top of mind and is something that is worth a hard look at and focusing on solving those things.
So what does digital transformation look like in oil and gas? Is there, you know, is there a strategy that most people have that kind of resonates across the market, or is it a little different depending on what you're talking about?
Well, I mean, the, you know, oil and gas itself is pretty much three micro industries within the larger industry, right? Because you have the different segments. So they're each looking at something differently. But historically, oil and gas has been a laggard in most things because in that industry, good enough is good enough, right? So they look at what they have and what's working, and it's, you know, you get hard pressed to change things that are successful, but they're being forced to, through business needs, move forward more in that transformational space. They need real-time understanding of what's happening, either from a production standpoint, what's even happening in the markets, and how do those compare to what their business is doing. I know one customer I worked with, they were really looking at aligning their actual operational production with their forecasted productions to ensure that they had as tight a gap there as possible, right? They want to be at zero, but pretty much impossible to do given all the variables that are involved there. But that, you know, that level of detail is necessary for them to be successful. So the transformation itself, I would say it depends on where you are in the segment, but there's definitely efforts amongst all of them to make sure that they can do that. And the real-time world applies to what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean,
and the segments you're talking about are upstream, midstream, and downstream? Is that?
Yeah. When I say the micro industries within there, yeah, you're correct, John. That's okay. Exactly what I'm referring to.
Yeah. I mean, so how
Sorry,
do you...
Sorry, Dave, I cut you off there.
Yeah, no worries. So you mentioned specifically, right, that it takes a lot for them to change. And you'd also kind of mentioned the... you know, the big public incident that occurred that I think, quite frankly, it woke most industrial verticals and sub verticals up that like, hey, wow, I don't know if we're doing enough. Square that circle a little bit, because in the manufacturing space, discrete, mostly manufacturing space, and maybe parts of the process space outside of the oil and gas specific sort of process sub vertical, in that, you know, there's this tug of war between, you know, how much do we focus on cyber? You know, how do I properly balance, operate the business and risk? And yet I would, at least from the outside looking in, I would agree with your statement, even on the cyber front, is that, you know, they're going to change only when they're somewhat forced to, because I see the same thing kind of in the discrete space. So what's the big, you know, I had a long time ago, I had a, kind of a change formula somebody showed, and it talks about how everyone needs pressure to change because change is so damn hard. So what's the pressure? Is it regulatory? Is it not wanting to end up on the cover of your favorite news publication, even though it feels like it happens every day? What's the pressure for that industry on the cyber front, Matt?
No, I think it's, I mean, I'm going to select D, all of the above. Right. I mean, you get a black eye when you have a security incident, right? You get a black eye when you're impeding supply. You get a black eye when you have a spill. I mean, there are so many things for this industry specifically that I think other industries, while being similar, I think they're not the target as much. And I think that's the other thing too. The oil and gas industry is always a target. I think the discrete manufacturing aspects of it's, I don't know, to me, it's in a building, right? It's got a roof on it. You know, less goes on. I think there's less things that the public sees or is more concerned with on the discrete side. So while I think it can be just as important, I think to many degrees, it's not as impactful if something happens, right? There's no manufacturer that's running an Exxon Valdez that has crashed on the rocks near Alaska, right? I mean, those types of things don't happen, so people focus on it. So that to me speaks to, you know, that's an extreme situation, but that's the pressure. There's a ton of, you know, public opinion that can go against these organizations. So they want to be extra careful that they mitigate that. There is the whole compliance front, right? I mean, you think of the TSA mandates that are put on our critical infrastructure and pipeline organizations. You think of things that are coming down from the EPA that can impact them negatively and literally cost them millions of dollars in fines, depending on what's happening. So I think all of that coupled together is the pressure, but there's a pragmatic approach that they have to take to be able to do these things, right? Updating legacy structures and systems is not cheap. And again, not to, you know, have it be a competition to, oh, well, upgrading the Boeing factory is cheaper than upgrading all the Marathon Petroleum refineries. But I think, in my limited opinion, I think that it might be a little bit, I'd say simpler, but I think the approach is different. Right. When I'm trying to upgrade these 2,000-3,000 acre facilities that are mainly 99% outdoors that have extremely volatile and hazardous products in them, it's a little different on how you have to do these upgrades. So, you know, handling that and the way they go about it makes it that much more complex to push back on some of that pressure. You know, the cost of the technology to handle these spaces is immense. I'm not as well versed in manufacturing, but I do know that these large petrochemical plants or refineries, when they do a turnaround to fix something or upgrade something or improve processes, I mean, it could cost them upwards of $250 million every time they do it. Now, granted, they're not doing it four times a year, but allocating for that cost of technology change and eliminating the technical debt that they have is a huge amount of money, especially because when you think of some of these facilities are 80 years old.
Oh, yeah. And
this goes back to what I said, good enough is good enough. It's working, right? I'm putting feedstock in, I'm getting product out. I don't care. Right. Obviously, safety is the number one concern over all of this. So sorry, John.
No, you're good. I was agreeing with you. And I don't know if you know this or not, but I actually got my start in sales in Houston calling on petrochem facilities. So one of the things that was always amazing to me was that they would say, we've got this line that's been, you know, this refining line that's been going since the 1940s. And even though they've got new processes and new procedures today, the old line still makes as good as or better product than the new stuff does. And, you know, it's like, why change? Why upgrade? Why do things? And part of it's because they can't buy things that, you know, to replace things on that old line anymore. So that, you know, that's one, you know, obsolescence is one reason to upgrade. But I always thought that was interesting that, you know, even though stuff's been running for 100 years, they still make acceptable product, right?
Right. And it may be, and to your point there, the product is the same, right? Whatever comes out of line number one is exactly the same as line number two. Now, what I would challenge people on that side is, what's the efficiency rate, right? What's the spread of input versus output, right? Am I truly getting, you know, 80% efficiency, or am I getting 97% efficiency out of my feedstocks? And I think that's where they're really looking for improvements. And sometimes that's chemistry, not necessarily technology, right? So there's new patents on things all the time that help them improve those things. That's where a lot of this IP is stored in companies like DuPont, Dow's, Exxon, et cetera, because they've refined and created processes based on chemistry that they own. Mm-hmm. That's specific efficiencies that they are getting a benefit from that definitely is worth more money probably than the products themselves.
It's interesting to compare and contrast that to your point, right? Like when I think of, you know, let's just take a generic process inside of a manufacturing plant, like a, I don't know, let's take a steel press, is that, you know, we've kind of, for the most part, tweaked those processes to the point where, you know, the getting the efficiencies out of them, there's not much more to be had. I'm not going to say that under certain circumstances with specific creative product types that suddenly the, you know, I'll call it the quality, or, you know, I'll call it the non-scrap rate coming off of that sucker at, you know, perfect production at 100%, you know, OEE kind of thing, it isn't necessarily possible. But we're pretty damn close to about as good as we're going to get.
And it may just be material. It may just be the materials made of some new alloy that improves that press efficiency. That may be it, right?
That's exactly it. But we've squeezed out all the water we're going to get out of the turnip in a lot of these cases. Whereas, you know, to your point, Matt, there's potentially still some, you know, chemistries left. you know, you might still get, you know, a little better, especially in cases where, you know, somebody actually owns the intellectual property. And so even if somebody else comes along later and decides, hey, that's a good idea, you're not, you know, you can't even do it even if you wanted to. I want to actually use this talk track. This is a good segue into the, you know, the buzzword bingo of the day, and that's, you know, AI and leveraging AI to improve some of these processes. And I'll tee up with a question. And that is, when I talk to traditional discrete manufacturers about it, I kind of talk about the, you know, POC purgatory. And I say, look, just because we can doesn't mean we should. And that is like the cost in some cases of, let's say, getting that additional percentage or two of quality product off the line that AI may be able to help us with, is the juice worth the squeeze? And I think what we're finding out is in a lot of cases, it's not. And so, or at least at the moment, which could change in a month. But at least at the moment, that's kind of where we are. I'm curious your take, Matt, on kind of, you know, is there an applicability there? If suddenly, you know, it might, hey, if I had, you know, additional edge compute to be able to, you know, build, train, and run a model that could improve some of the, you know, some of those processes, is it a thing over there? Is more of a cultural hump that you got to get over? What's the general consensus, and maybe what's your feelings on it?
At first, a commendation. You made it 20 minutes without saying AI, which I think is fantastic.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Shoot. I guess I owe somebody $50.
Just to understand your question there, is that are you asking how AI is fitting into oil and gas as an industry, or I just want to make sure I understand what the question is.
Yeah, I want to hear what you believe is the reality over there. And, you know, or even like, hey, the industry thinks this, but Matt thinks that, if they're different.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think as a whole, AI in and of itself, right, and its potential is amazing. I think where industry is in general, and I'm not going to just say oil and gas, I think just in general, people are looking for what are the real reasons to do it. You mentioned, you know, POC hell. I mean, to me, I think what people get caught up in is, how do I use this? What do I do with it? How can I map what this can provide me to my business? And, you know, that's why I always go back to the old business architecture days. It's like, I know what I want. I know what I have. What's that gap in the middle? Oh, maybe AI can do it. That's good. But what are the specific things that AI can provide you, right? So it's balancing, you know, those actual outcomes with a strategy, and they give you kind of like this, what I like to call, and I think we call organizationally, is practical AI, right? So it's prioritizing use cases and time to value, and where can you actually show that and it be perceived across an entire organization?
Yeah,
and
real business outcomes.
That is how you get there. Yeah. Exactly. And something, right, we talk about the, you know, I forgot the little shortcut for goals. What did we call it? Star goals? No.
SMART.
MAST. SMART. Thank you. To me, exactly the same for anything you're doing in AI. What is the POC? How does it map directly to my business outcomes? And how quickly can I get there? And if you look at every one of your use cases in those terms, you'll be able to narrow that scope and be able to show things more quickly. And if you do it correctly and you layer your components appropriately, you'll definitely be able to reuse things in a foundational way so that you're not recreating some of those parts and pieces of what you're doing for AI.
Yeah, I'm stealing that. Smart AI. I'm stealing that.
I like it. With all of the same metrics, right? Yeah. Like, let's time bound it, guys. Like, don't allow the POC to go on forever. Let's get specific. Let's make it measurable, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I
mean,
love
to me,
it.
That's the only way you can do it, right?
Yep.
Is having that mapping makes it relevant. And so when you take that conversation out of an IT discussion and you can take it to the COO or people who are actually influencing the business decisions, they can see a path to that implementation and they can see that it's relevant. With all of that, though, comes our responsibility on this side of the table to be able to communicate in business terms that aren't just technological buzzwords and boxes, right? I mean, that's the big thing as well. And then understanding the whole AI, what does that mean? Is it RAG, LLM? Is it some kind of ML type scenario? Is it digital twins? I mean, they all fit into that bucket of AI. And so it's determining which is the appropriate path for what things are being done.
Yeah. Large language model, small language model. Yeah, you're exactly right. And it's another, you know, there's another acronym hell that we get into when we start talking about AI. There's all the acronyms associated with it. So it's crazy. But the other thing that Dave and I talk about a lot is we've been doing AI for a long time. We just didn't call it that. So there's a lot of processes and things we've been doing, vision systems, and, you know, for error proofing and manufacturing. That's an ML type application. I mean, even, you know, our cyber vision, some of the cybersecurity products out there are doing some of the same, implementing some of the same technology that we're talking about in AI. So it's out there. It's just, you know, now that's what everybody seems to want to talk about.
Yeah, well,
your point about we've been doing AI for a long time, we've never called it that. It's the same with IoT. IoT, yep. IoT, IoT. It's like, have you heard of SCADA? It's kind of the same. I mean, a little different, not as powerful as IoT, but the concepts are there, right? So I treated the same type of thing. We used something, it was working, but we didn't necessarily call it by what that new term is. Now, AI goes to a whole other level. I mean, we know the deep fakes and all the things that people can do, the power behind what AI can do. I mean, it's definitely different. But yeah, to your point, we've been doing, you know, this type of technology or this type of, I don't know what you'd even call it, not even necessarily technology. I won't put
almost
it that
like
way,
analysis, but, right? We've been doing this type of, yeah. You know,
yes.
Decision-making analysis.
Based on the analysis that you do.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I would even make an argument that in some cases, to your point around us doing it for a long time, what we're really talking about is just now, you know, we're to the point where the masses actually kind of, the light bulb went on. It's like, wait, oh my gosh, you mean technology can actually help us, you know, with, you know, everything from scoring sales leads to improving quality on a widget to, you know, screening support calls and understanding when someone's voice is really, really pissed off and maybe we should escalate them to the front of the line so they're not waiting on hold for the full 8 minutes. Like there's suddenly this recognition that I think from the masses of the, like, how applicable technology is, that's certainly the cool part. I think what we need to hopefully avoid is, you know, and I've started, and again, this is potentially something totally different. This is specifically the LLM space and the, you know, leveraging the Star GPT products in order to, you know, help you clean language up or whatever. But I've gotten very specific on, like, if I work on something and I don't use a tool to help me, I'll say, hey, you know, take a look at this. By the way, this was made without the benefit of AI-enabled tools. Like, this came from Dave Gutshaw. Because I don't like the slippery slope that is this concept that we suddenly can get rid of all of the entry-level people that we hire to do some of this work, because entry-level people become later in career people. And suddenly, if we get rid of all the entry-level people, we're in, you know, some of these, we're going to feel it in 10 years and it's going to be too late.
Well, I think to that point, I don't think so. That cause and effect that you're talking about there is using AI to minimize early in career people. I mean, honestly, and I'm not saying it's we should embrace it and that's the way we go because of something I'm about to say. But how did RPA impact people who were actually doing things that we would say would be low value tasks? Right. I mean, RPA replaced how many people that were picking up a phone and just helping guide a phone conversation to the correct resources. I mean, RPA in its own way was AI, right? Now, it was more a ladder logic type thing, but to me, things were being decided upon in an automated fashion through RPA. And I don't think that that's fundamentally different from what the power of AI can be and the impact that it can have.
Yeah, and we're in an age now where the processing power has become so great that we can accomplish a lot of the things more easily than we and add additional value on top of that than what we could before.
Yeah, with the RPA thing, like I said, it was ladder logic. Now you have RPA that is being enhanced by AI, right? It's got adaptive learning built into it now. So it can almost predict based on an early questioning what's going to happen, right? And there's the actual cognitive abilities now behind RPA. So it's, you know, making something that's been acceptable better, right? And I also think that, you know, to your point, Dave, AI is misused so many times. You have people who would just generate a document or a white paper using all of AI. Well, the beauty is that if you know the topic, you can typically tell. I mean, that's the one good thing. If you're just putting something out there for the masses, they'll probably never know. But where it becomes important is when, if I try to do something around digital transformation for manufacturing and I let AI write the entire white paper for me, I think you guys will be able to look at it and say, yeah, this is not legit, right? And be able to tell pretty quick if it's real or not.
Too many big words, too many buzzwords.
Well, so it's placeholder words. Usually they give it away, right?
I try to write like I talk, and if it sounds like it's several levels above how I normally talk, then you can pretty well identify that it's AI.
Yeah, but I mean, the bottom line is we all need to be a little more careful. You can't just take things at face value anymore, even if it's a video. I think we all have gotten to the point where we have to be skeptical of everything we're seeing.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, so what's funny about that, right, is quite frankly, everyone should have been doing that all along. You know, the whole trust but verify thing.
Thank you, Ronald.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think what we've lost is in some cases because everybody now has the attention span of a gnat. We've lost both the critical thinking skill and the ability to look at things critically. And now what we've got is we've got these two things making a problem worse. And that is you originally had time to critically think. You didn't have algorithms spoon feeding you what the algorithm thinks you want to engage with, which is generally whatever the current outrage du jour is. Well, you combine that with attention spans of a gnat, and now it's two really awful self-reinforcing items. We don't have the focus to be able to go out and figure out whether the outrage of the day makes sense. And now we're going to, you know, I don't believe the volume is anywhere close to what it's eventually going to be, and that is the volume of garbage. There's going to be way more fake news and footage and things that we might get to a point where the only thing you believe is the thing that you saw for yourself. And that's a whole separate scary thing, because suddenly you're not going to believe anything, even the real stuff. And so how do you balance that? I don't know. We could have a whole nother podcast on just this topic.
We certainly could.
And you know, you can apply this now. Let's bring this back to the business, right? And businesses that are trying to leverage AI. I mean, some of the big components of that, right? I already mentioned, and I don't want to reiterate some of this, but I think it's important if we're going to, you know, the AI discussion just in general, there's the big Wild West AI that we're kind of getting into, but bringing that back more to a practical sense, I think there has to be an organizational readiness for this, right? You measure that organizational readiness in several ways, right? Do you have the use cases, right? We talked about that a little bit. Leadership, right? Are the people there to support the effort? Because if you have this, you know, underlying eight people who are, you know, not leadership or not in a position to actually push things through, that's probably not going to happen. I think there needs to be an actual strategy developed by that leadership. So what's going to happen? I think to some of your points earlier, Dave, about how AI can replace people, there's got to be a cultural education that happens so that people understand that that's not the case, right? Here's the things that AI means to us. Here's why we're doing it. Where is that alignment between the culture and the business? How can they, you know, communicate that? And then to the point of the fakes and what's going on, there's got to be a serious consideration for governance, right? The enterprise programs for data governance, compliance, security, privacy, all those things have to be wrapped up in it. And to me, getting those five things in alignment is key to making AI successful. But also, I will say AI being friendly and actually being useful and not becoming Skynet.
We've all seen those movies, right?
Yeah.
So we certainly don't want it to be that.
No, and I think one of you bring up a good point too, Matt, that I think is lost, and that is not enabling systems to make too many unsupervised and automated changes to an environment outside of its direct control and not allowing its direct control capabilities to spread. And what I mean by that is, you know, allowing automation, right? It's no different than a factory. You're going to allow let's say a programmable logic controller to control just that one process. You probably wouldn't put that controller in charge of everything from the front gates of the facility to the building management system to the water recycling system to the et cetera, right?
Not that same controller, no.
Not that same controller. You're going to keep them separate and siloed and allow them to be fit for purpose. The same logic has to continue to apply so that we don't get exactly what you said. So we don't get some version of our dystopian novels like Skynet where it decides that, you know, kind of on its own, it can do a little bit more than it was told that it could do. And suddenly we get unintended consequences.
I can see great applications for it in networking, you know, network optimization. I can see great opportunity for improvement there in security, you know, in helping identify anomalies, malware, things like that in a oil and gas plant, manufacturing plant, what have you. I see great opportunity for it there. I just, you know, it's we're getting on one side of the pendulum. We don't want it to swing too far the other way and have it be effective or thought to be effective for everything, because it's not. We always joke about private 5G. We thought that was going to take over, and it, it has its place, and it does do things well in the things it's made a mark in, but it's not going to be solve everything. So I think you have to look at it through the right lens.
Yeah. And, you know, the AI thing, you know, you did your star GPT or however you referred to it, Dave, earlier. I think that security, compliance, governance is so important. And I think people are struggling with how to do that, because my question is, if you have an LLM, it's you're running either in your business or it doesn't matter where, how can you be reasonably assured that it hasn't been poisoned, right? Because if you're just typing in, you know, stuff to get returns, how, at what point do you, would you say, hey, this is really wacky. Why is it giving me this information? It's, you know, you could probably poison it out. Well, it may not, right. I mean, but I think sometimes hallucinations you can tell, I think, right? But yeah, sometimes you're correct, John. It's going to be just flat out stated in such a way. It's like, oh, okay, well, that's what I need to do. But I think you could poison it in a way that it would be so discreet and slow, you may not ever catch on that it is, because things are changing so incrementally. Mm-hmm. The biggest example I can do of this is a long time ago when I was working at, I won't say the customer name, but I was working as the customer in this place. As a prank, we removed a stick of RAM out of one of our coworkers' desktops. And every couple of days, we removed another stick. We started with 16 gig of RAM. I don't remember how much. It doesn't matter. I think it was Meg at the time.
I was going to say, so it was a long time ago.
Meg RAM. Yeah. So anyway, we slowly removed a stick of RAM out of his computer every couple of days. And finally, it was after a week, and I think we had gotten him down to 2 meg of RAM. And he's like,
oh my God.
Yeah, my system's been so slow lately. Right? He's like, but they took that long. And I think the concept of poisoning an LLM could be the same, that you just start inserting things into it that just point things in just a little bit of the wrong direction. Right. And if you're talking about things that are extremely sensitive to that level of detail, it could be something significant. And again, that's my, I don't say fear, but my concern is, how can you be certain? What processes do you have to run to check some your LLM to ensure that it's giving you the same type of outputs that it was previously, that something hasn't happened?
Yeah, you almost need some kind of, you know, just like we do random, you know, random quality checks in cases where it's impossible to do quality checks against each one. What do? We grab one every so often and then we take it back into the lab. We peel the sucker apart and we look at it in absolute ridiculous minute detail to make sure, you know, nothing's changing. You almost need a similar kind of thing.
Yeah, you're going to have that.
You're going to have to. Like, the idea that you don't have that, that's a great point, Matt, because you even see the same thing, quite frankly, on everybody's used to using. And that is, if you ask your favorite, you know, GPT, something that you know just a little bit about, the output looks really good. And then you give it to somebody that actually knows the space and you read it and you're like, what the, no, this isn't actually accurate. I think that's the danger in this case, is that if you have someone that, you know, just kind of knows the process at a high level, they're not going to notice the frog beginning to boil. Whereas, you need that manual human inspection to validate it. Yeah, spot on. So we've got about 10 minutes left. Let's pivot a different direction. Where do we want to go?
What's it like working for a partner versus working for a manufacturer?
It's different. You know, when I was at Cisco, and you guys know this, right? I mean, let's focus on Cisco. This is what we have to do. And you have that bucket that you're concerned with. Well, when you're on the partner side, we have 30 buckets, right? So it becomes a little more of a challenge, not necessarily for, hey, we need to have to position X OEM, but it's more about the choices, right? Where do you go? How do you guide the customer? If they're not coming to you saying, hey, we want this, right? The challenge is then you really want to find them what's best suited, right? Amongst all of the vendors and partners that we have. So that's one of the big challenges that I've discovered being on this side, is it's more complex in that regard, because you just don't have that one bucket to pull things out of, right? At Cisco, it's like, we don't really want that, don't like that, bad experience, whatever else. There was typically some other product, but that was still Cisco. that you could position. Here, it's not only it's a different product, there's a whole different layer of knowledge that you either have to know or find somebody that knows to be able to dive in. So that would be kind of the biggest difference that I have here.
Been in the channel, and it's it can definitely be a challenge to. I haven't been in the channel, you know, in the Cisco vernacular channel, but I have run distributorships and been involved in companies that are large distributors, and it can be a challenge because you're right. It's how do I make sure I'm selecting the best in breed to solve the problem?
Yeah, it's funny. At the same time, go ahead, Matt.
I was gonna say just real quick on that too, and at the same time, balancing the relationships that you have with your largest OEMs that you work with, right? Because there's a delicate balance there because, you know, it's public knowledge. I mean, Cisco is our largest partner. And I think we are Cisco's largest partner in return, right?
You are.
That also makes it a challenge because there's personal relationships and personal ideas and personal opinions that tend to impact some of these things that happen as well. And I don't mean like, oh, I don't like Cisco, we're not going to sell them. First off, that'd be so short-sighted and ignorant because largest partner on both sides. That's it. But the thorn is like when you walk into a customer and they say, no, I don't want
breaks.
I don't want this vendor. Okay, well, how do I either not come across as trying to force this vendor down their throat because I know it might be better for them, but how do I now answer to that vendor and say, yeah, you're out, right? So there's those pieces of this as well that I think is, I don't want to say it's political, but it almost is in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or it's not political from your end customer standpoint, but it sure a heck is political on the back end. To your point, well, you're our largest or nearly largest. We do all this business for you. What do you mean you're not positioning us first? You're like, well, hold on a second. I'm doing what my customer says for me to do.
Right. That goes into critical conversations. Somebody's going to say something. For sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, there's that Critical Conversations book that everybody needs to read because that would be
Crucial Conversations, I think it is. Yes.
That's it. Okay.
That is a good book.
I was looking at my critical thinking binder, my book over there, and that's why I got critical in my brain. So
there you go. Yeah, it's critical too.
But to me, that's the big things I think that are really different. But otherwise, I mean, it's good. It's broadened my knowledge base for sure because I've had to come into contact with so many different solutions. So, you know, at Cisco, it was always more on the competitive side, like who is a direct competitor for this that we're positioning. So understanding that. But here it's just, you look at one thing, let's look at secure remote access. I know you both are really familiar with that. I mean, there are literally, you know, dozens of solutions that handle secure remote access for OT, which, you know, working at Cisco, I never really thought about that many of them because there was like one, two, maybe five that we would say were competitors.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot more than that. And having to understand the differences between them and what they do differently and why one would be better suited for another customer is, you know, it can be challenging. But that's why we also have specialists, right? We can turn to the specialists and say, hey, here's a scenario. Here's the four things I'm looking at. Help me figure out what the best path is. So, I mean, there's give and take here for sure.
Right. Hey, so one other question along those lines, you know, partner, manufacturer, how are some of the changes that we are making internally? And I'm sure there's more to come and nothing many levels above my pay grade. How are they being viewed outside in from a partner looking at us?
I think it probably depends on what specific areas you're looking at, right? Like you were talking about the Splunk acquisition of Cisco. I mean, that's being seen totally differently, I'm sure, than it is from that side. And yes, I did say it that way on purpose. But, you know, it is a big depends. I was on a customer call today that was none, you know, concerned with some of the decisions coming out of industrial networking. What's happening there? How are some of the roadmap items? What do they look like? Right. So I think it's just a depends. Like, I think a lot of people like the idea of the changes that have been happening, like consolidation within the business itself. Right. Like, how security is all coming together as one, how networking is coming together as one, right? The organizational changes, I think, make a lot of sense when people see them from the outside. Now, how they're impacting you on the internal, you know, no idea, but they look like they make sense. And I think that gives people a better feel, a better outlook on those changes and what the impacts are going
to
be.
Well, thanks for that. Yeah, I wasn't trying to steer you in any specific direction there. I'm just genuinely curious because I look at it, internally, I see what's going on, but I don't always know how that's viewed from your lens. So thanks for that.
We know everything you look through, John, is rose-colored glasses.
Well, you don't know me very well, do you? No, I'm kidding. It's change is inevitable in this, just in any industry, really. But you know, it's been interesting to watch, and you know, both good and bad.
Yeah, you just got to roll with it, right? I mean, that's the thing. And don't fret over things you have no control over.
Yep. Right? Control,
which is just about all of them, right? So
right.
Yep. Cool. Well, we are bumping up against the 45 minute mark here.
I only have two more hours. Yes.
Yeah. There you go. Right. Right. Well, so many topics we could go into detail. I just have kind of one question, Matt, and that is, I want to go back to the cybersecurity stuff for a quick second. From your lens, in the industry that you're in, you have a different view, kind of, I think, from a lot of others. What is, over the holidays, personally or in an industry role, what is one thing you should do to harden your cybersecurity footprint or policy?
You know what? You know, we talk about all the different things, right? Between threat prevention, right? How are we going to secure this? I mean, the one thing that I've seen that's had the biggest impact on giving people assistance in securing things is the idea of visibility into their environments. What do I have? What is talking to what? And who is accessing what, right? By being able to have that visibility alone, even if you're doing it on a manual-based process, you could begin to shut things down from an attack surface perspective. When you're blindly looking at these things or some tools that are giving you no insights, where are you, right? So to me, the biggest single thing I think people could do to move them forward would be visibility.
I like it. With that, I think we close up. Matt, thank you so much for joining today. We really appreciate it. Everybody out there, have a great afternoon, evening, night, and happy Merry Christmas holidays.
Thanks for having me. It was a good talk.
Well said. Great having you, Matt. And we look forward to the next one. Thanks again.
Take care,
everybody.
Bye-bye.